You are listening to Radiant Creators, a collaborative project composed of people whose passion, purpose, and dedication requires forging their own unique path of empowerment and livelihood. A Radiant Creator isn't making a living, they are living. Today, Malcolm Saunders is joining us to discuss how to recreate your relationship to food. Malcolm is a passionate educator in the field of health and nutrition and an intuitive chef who enjoys teaching others how to make their own energizing and healing superfoods. Malcolm has created events and shared the stage with world-renowned speakers including David Wolf and Daniel Vitalis, and is the visionary founder behind The Light Cellar, a health food store and community teaching kitchen located in Alberta, Canada. Today, with so many divergent diets, clashing opinions, and research being touted, everything from vegan to paleo to ketogenic, many people are left confused as to what exactly to eat for optimal health. Malcolm brings what he calls a food scope approach to intuitive eating and also discusses some of the optimal superfoods, such as chocolate and medicinal mushrooms, to consider adding to our diets. We'll also discuss the importance of gut health in building a strong immune system and healthy brain function. Welcome, Malcolm.
Malcolm Saunders is the founder of The Light Cellar, a unique health food store and learning kitchen located in Calgary, Canada. The Light Cellar was created out of Malcolm's passionate mission to educate and connect people to their food. Malcolm, what were the catalysts that led up to the day you created the concept of Light Cellar in your basement back in 2008-2009?
Yeah, well, I guess there was two parts to that. One was the food nutrition piece, which was The Light Cellar is an extension of my own journey exploring the world of food nutrition, trying to figure it out, going deeper and deeper down the rabbit holes that I was. And so there's that side, having spent years personal study as well as some kind of formal study and training, took a nutrition degree program, had worked in commercial kitchens, both paid and volunteer positions at retreat centers and that kind of thing. So there was the piecing together on that side. And then there was the other side of becoming an entrepreneur, becoming a business owner, which was really an extension of, again, multifaceted. There was, A, I hated having jobs. I had yet to find a job where I was like, yes, like I love showing up every day.
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
Right?
It's a good thing.
Yeah. And, you know, I truly, I really wanted to create a life that was, you know, a life of freedom, that was an extension of who I was, that I could just, you know, be inspired and create. And also, you know, another big, big part of it was to really, you know, create value and offer something to the world that would hopefully positively change it in a bigger way than I could make as an employee in that sense. So there's those two pieces.
Well, I love that you say you want to, you know, create a life of freedom.
That's what we're all about. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right? So it's like that alarm doesn't go off at 7:30 and you got to get up and, you know, get on the train and get downtown and get in your, you know, your place of work and, yeah, be there for 8 hours and then go home and then live your life.
Yeah, you really can't live your life an hour a day and maybe like 4 hours on the weekends. I mean, I tried for many years, but it doesn't work. I mean, how hard you beat yourself up or how hard you try, life is not lived 10 hours a month.
No, for sure, right?
So Malcolm, I wanted to ask you a question about the different food choices that are available today. There's all these divergent theories on the best diets, from paleo, vegan, to ketogenic, all of them backed by science, by those in favor of each. And what I've noticed is people are fighting more and more over their food choices and lifestyles. So for instance, I've noticed on my Facebook feed, if you've seen that documentary, What the Health? Have you seen that on Netflix?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's caused quite a bit of fear, I've noticed, in people, and confusion is about what they should eat. A lot of them are saying, well, what can I eat? Just grass? I mean, so it's provided more confusion than it has more than education. Why does this have to be so complicated?
I know, man, I feel you. And I've, you know, been going through that for so many years, and where I eventually landed and what I'm trying to teach now is, you know, let's get out of dogma. It really is. It comes down to that, where we become dogmatic, we become strict. And I was there. I know that because I was an extreme hardcore vegan, vegetarian for more than 10 years. Then I got into being a vegan, and then I got a raw vegan. I contemplated fruitarian. It seemed the only path was to become a breatharian. so it's true. It's like we can go down these rabbit holes. We can get really extreme. We can get really dogmatic. And what I found that the best path through is being what my friend Yara Willard calls a flexitarian, an opportunivore, being more flexible about our food choices, not so rigid, not so dogmatic. It's not black and white. And, you know, life is bigger than that. So I've developed a system called what I call a food scope. And this is just an acronym to help people navigate through the world of food and nutrition, because it does get so confusing. And especially in our kind of modern day, our society, and, you know, like we've lost a lot of our cultural wisdom. And this is good and bad, right? It's like we have so much free choice. Like we can eat anything we want, you know, especially in North America, you know, available to us 24/7, 365. Like if you want grapes in the middle of the night in January, you can have them, right?
And it's true.
We've never faced this problem / opportunity before. And the other thing that's happening, we're such a kind of a science-based culture, which is not bad, but it does also present some problems. So this idea of this food scope is how to kind of, you know, come at this intelligently, right? So it's increasing one's food intelligence, I call it. You know, we're all familiar with IQ and even the concept of EQ, you know, emotional intelligence, where you're able to kind of discern between your emotions and another's, and you can make, you know, choices and decisions based upon that. You're not getting muddled and mixed up in that. So equally, food intelligence, or your FQ, which I've coined, allows you to really sift through that information and not be that lemming and just kind of blindly follow and fall off the cliff, being influenced, be it science or opinions or whatever it is. So, you know, you really need to look at a food through many angles and many lenses. And so again, that acronym of SCOPE starts with S, S, which stands for science. Science is great. It's wonderful. We can learn a lot about a food and a diet and nutrition. So science can offer us two things. It can offer us, you know, what is in a food or a diet. We can, you know, look at it both ways. But let's just take a food, for instance. You know, what are the vitamins, the minerals, the nutrients, the protein, etc.? Science is able to break that down and tell us. The other thing it can do is it can offer us, you know, what are the effects of that food? How does it affect our body, our organs, our systems? And that can provide a lot of insight and a lot of value, right? I mean, before we knew what vitamin C was, we were dealing with scurvy a whole lot more. But it's not the be-all, end-all. We have to understand, as great and wonderful that is, nutrition science is still very new. We don't know, we don't have the complete picture. But yet in our culture, you know, we place such a high importance on science and you know, the kind of this rational thought and reason. So tied in with you know, the big picture of intelligent eating or just intelligence in general, you know, ration and reason and intellect is great and it's wonderful. However, you know, there's kind of risks that come when we don't acknowledge that other side, which is the more kind of instinctual and intuitive. So I have another course I teach about intuitive eating, which plays into this idea of intelligent eating and really going with one's gut and what feels good. So as we go through these lenses of the scope, starting with science, we need to put it in perspective. So science, especially nutrition science, still is very young. And especially when you hear about, you know, nutrition headlines is often how we hear, you know, the results of studies. Sometimes it's out of context. So we really need to put that into context as well as the bigger picture that, you know, there's more to viewing a food and approaching your health than just beyond science. So it has its place, it has its role, but we got to put it in perspective. So a lot of value it can provide us, but it's not the be all end all. It's just, again, one lens that is useful and that it's helpful. The next one is culture. So S and then C for culture, which wonderful lens and arguably, I'd say potentially even more powerful than science, in as much as what the cultural wisdom represents and understanding of food and nutrition, it has hundreds, thousands of years of success, and culture encodes information, and we are easily able to, you know, benefit from that, knowing, you know, like, okay, when to harvest or what to harvest, how to prepare certain foods. There's a lot of intelligence encoded in culture that has made us healthy and allowed us to successfully reproduce over generations. And a lot of it is just being, you know, verified and backed by science. As science begins to look and, you know, dissect it in the ways that it can, it's going, oh yeah, well, that's why culturally we've done this, or, you know, this affirms what this culture believed. It sometimes comes in different terminology, like in the case of fermentation. Some cultures believed it was magical spirits or, you know, something. They didn't really know what was going on. And science goes, well, it's actually, you know, microbes, it's bacteria, it's this, it's that. And so there's two different languages that are kind of, you know, pointing at the same thing. But the culture has a lot longer, deeper history and a real successful track record. The unfortunate thing and the challenge is we're losing a lot of those cultural traditions, and we're moving into kind of the modern culture of way of eating, which is, you know, the standard American diet, the SAD diet, they call it, right? Based on, you know, the four food groups and the food guide, which doesn't have a long history. And it was kind of sort of manufactured in a sense to help us make through the war efforts. And of course, it's been influenced by, you know, advertising and industrial agriculture. And I think, you know, that biggest influence of where we've gone wrong with our food and our diet has come from industrialization, of which our modern, again, you know, the broadest reaching teachings that our culture gives us directly and indirectly comes through our industrialized society. And that to me is the biggest dividing line beyond, you know, meat versus plants. Again, I used to be a hardcore vegetarian, and I had all the science and all the kind of, you know, like the movies out today, like, oh, it's destroying the environment, it's bad for your health. But really, it's not plants versus animals. It's actually the scale at which it's all being done. You can look at, you know, corn or soy or wheat. It's grown en masse, you know, industrially, and not good for the environment, definitely not good for your health. Just the same as, you know, raising livestock in feedlots, you know, isn't where they're being fed corn and not, you know, their natural diet of grass.
Oh, yeah. Converse.
Yeah, I mean, this, you know, so it's, again, it's not a black and white. So if we come back to culture as a lens, it's very important. And, you know, there's a mentor of mine, Terry Willard. He's a, you know, four-decade herbalist, practicing herbalist, a lot of wisdom. And, you know, him seeing so many clients over these years, and especially a lot of people, young people, you know, kind of going down the path of learning about food and nutrition and really getting lost, like I did for so many years. His one big point of advice is, if you ever got lost, you know, come back to what your ancestors ate. And I think there's some sound, valuable advice there. However, again, like science is not the be all end all. We need to kind of, you know, update it, buffer it. We live in a very different time than our ancestors did. So, and oftentimes we kind of dramatize or, you know, take out of context what we think our ancestors might have done. And this idea, this trend of the paleo, or a lot of people in my community are into, you know, the Weston A. Price, and, you know, it's full on heavy fat and protein and this and that. And, you know, they have their steak and eggs breakfast, and then they go off to their office job and they sit all day. And it's like, well, you're, you know, like, that's misalignment with, you know, sure, maybe your ancestors ate that way, but they certainly didn't sit down all day. They had a much more active lifestyle that actually utilized that fat and protein. And also, too, they had different stressors. Like today, we've got a lot more kind of mental and emotional stressors. We have a lot more toxins in our environment. So, of course, we need to shift our strategy that way. So culture, major, major value, really good lens to look at a diet or food through. We can get so much value. Another great example of kind of the great, you know, treasures that cultural wisdom has is when some of the kind of the earlier British and European explorers had come over to North America. I remember this one account I heard of them up north, and they were advised by the Inuit, the natives up there, you know, don't eat the polar bear livers. And, you know, they didn't heed that advice. And you can actually get what's called a hypervitaminosis, which is a vitamin A toxicity, basically, because those animals that are far up north, they concentrate so much vitamin A in their livers that if you eat them, it becomes toxic. And they actually, in fact, have to you know, hide and keep away the livers even from their dogs, because that would kill the dog. And, you know, of course, the British, you know, they're all knowing, teetotaling, like didn't heed that advice, thinking they knew better. But, you know, to their detriment, that was some really key cultural wisdom that they had and knew, but wasn't scientifically backed, wasn't, you know, this kind of superior Western, based understanding. So it wasn't followed until the British, you know, experienced it otherwise. So
it wasn't heeded. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Other thing we need to watch out, you know, for with culture is, you know, just because past cultures consumed it doesn't always mean it's good. There's been lots of cultural biases, and every culture has its own bias. And a great example is our insects. Some one culture would eat one type of insect, and another culture looks at that culture and going, "You eat that? That's disgusting." But yet they eat another food that's, you know, totally gross. And, you know, even in our kind of North American culture, lobsters used to be considered a very lowly food, and it was fed to prisoners. You know, but now. It's like now we've elevated that food. Oh, that's a very, you know, great food. But generally, I tend to look at what do some of cultures, you know, revere? What were some of their like staples that they really like thrived off of? So, you know, one of the trends recently has been, you know, like the omega-3s and people getting into flaxseed. Well, flax, culturally, if you look at it, has never been consumed as a staple food. Right. It was used more industrially, you know, linseed oil, linen. It had industrial purposes, less of a food purpose. Compare that with to something that's almost identical in terms of its offering and its nutrients is chia. You know, again, high in omega-3s, has that soluble fiber, you know, similar properties and benefits. And if you look at that culturally, that has been consumed throughout time and indeed like revered as one of their top foods. So again, it's always a good check, especially as we hear, you know, these kind of, you know, oh, it's the new greatest superfood. And it's, you know, again, science could say, look, it's higher in these certain nutrients, but, you know, was it consumed? Does it have a track record of being consumed as a staple? Not to say if it wasn't, it's wrong, but it's a good kind of lead and indication. And, you know, soy, another great example, you know, especially as a vegetarian when I first started, it was, you know, first thing you're supposed to do is go out and buy some soy milk because you're vegetarian and drink soy milk. And, you know, like we've gone on this whole soy bandwagon because we've looked at some Eastern cultures, particularly the Japanese. Oh, they consume soy. They got low rates of cancer, cardiovascular. That must be it. And suddenly we're eating soy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner because it's wonderful. It's full of protein. It's got all these properties. But we look back at the cultures we're, you know, trying to emulate and get the inspiration from, they actually consumed it in small amounts, more as a condiment and especially fermented. So anyways. Yeah, go ahead.
And would that fermentation of soy be more of a tempeh or more of a tofu?
Yeah, tofu itself isn't fermented. So yeah, tempeh. Fermented, miso, these kinds of things. So they did consume it for sure in unfermented forms like edamame. It's quite fresh, but you know, more limited quantities because of, you know, the estrogenic effects. There's been books written on how it's possibly not the best food ever, and how fermentation really helps transform it into something more utilizable and digestible.
Yeah, I like what you mentioned, how science can kind of prove anything, where I remember when I was in Seattle, there was something very popular there right now is the French fry diet. And there's all kinds of science that the hipsters will reference to say that, hey, French fries, if you live on those, it's actually the perfect food.
Oh, wow.
And you think that, well, if you look at it strictly scientifically, especially with a lot of bias, you can people can do silly things. It's like the I've read some books by people who espouse the paleo ideals, and I do like those, but they'll make it very clear in their books that if you eat more than 20 grams of carbs a day, you're going to die.
Right.
And it's like, doesn't make any sense. And so it seems that when people really, 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 really push science, that it kind of cancels common sense. And you mentioned, you know, what did our ancestors do? Like the idea of ancestral nutrition, as like Daniel Vitalis, I think, coined it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And again, you know, that was also partly the limit of culture. A lot of it really was based on, you know, seasonality, availability. Again, both a blessing and a curse in that way, where we have access and availability to so much more. Doesn't mean that it's wrong just because our ancestors didn't eat it. But yeah, we really need to, you know, sort through it all. And yeah, it's one of our challenges of the day. And how can we come back to more kind of common sense? So you brought up another great point, which will lead us to the next acronym.
Oh, yeah.
Which is other people's opinions, of which our world is plentiful.
Facebook.
Right? Now, there's and it's proven, it's known that we are influenced by other people's opinions. Again, I think for both better and the worse, there's a lot of value in that, but it's also an area of concern. I mean, I remember growing up, I wanted to eat, you know, Shreddies because, you know, Wayne Gretzky was on the box, right? Well, if he did it, it's going to be good for me. So we can be highly influenced. And I think that's built in for evolutionary, you know, aspects where it's very useful. And what opinions will do is it'll kind of help fast track, you know, our success. I mean, here you and I, we're having this conversation. You're just trying out the French fry diet. Maybe you love it. And it's like, gets me kind of curious. Or you're like, you know what? Totally crazy. I tried it. I felt awful. That's going to help me. I don't have to go through all that trial and error myself. I can, especially if you and I have a rapport. And you mentioned someone like Daniel Vitalis. Yeah, a friend of mine who I've been following his work for a long time. And you know, I value his opinion because I know his experience, I know his due diligence versus, you know, a lot of people love Dr. Oz or Oprah, you know, for instance, and will just follow and jump on any kind of bandwagon and, you know, different relationships, saying, not saying right or wrong, but from opinions, we need to really look at the source, right? Okay, who's speaking? What's the context? The raw food diet, you know, so many kind of quote unquote experts, of which I was trying to position myself as one as well. Very like, you know, young in the diet. It was still within the first few years. And I'm saying, this is it. This is the way. We should all eat this way forever. It's the perfect diet. But, you know, you take it out of context. I mean, I remember Daniel saying, you know, he asked this question of me. He's like, okay, Malcolm, how many, you know, vegans do you know that have been doing it for 10 years or more? And I'm like, well, okay, I could probably pick out 3 or 4. He's like, 20 years? And I was like, well, okay, supposedly this guy. And he's like, 30 years? And he's like, you know, maybe if you could come up with one. It's only one guy and you don't even really know the context of that. There's never been, you know, generationally successful vegans. There's no culture in the world that's a vegan culture unless they're some kind of specific sect of society, like religious organization. But even then, they're probably not breeding, so it's not, you know, fair to say that's optimal diet.
Yeah, and it's so small. It's so small.
It's small. Yeah. And what we realized is, you know, my wife and our family, we had a young daughter at the time, like we were trying to do this. It's like, this is the way and we're going to be so healthy. But it was mostly single middle-aged men in their 20s to 40s going, this is the best diet. And you stick a young nursing mother on it and she just gets massively depleted. And I saw so many children that were also depleted. And, you know, our family was kind of on that brink, that risk. And we noticed the signs and began to rethink it and turn around. But we do need to really question and look deeper to what other people are suggesting. Again, it can be wonderful. It can really help, you know, fast track us, you know, in the right direction. But sometimes it can take us the wrong direction.
Are you seeking the truth or just an ideal? Yeah, big difference.
So, but ultimately, it all comes down to kind of the end of the acronym. So SCOPE, our food scope, S-C-O, and then P-N-E, which is personal experience. So, you know, what works for us? And great, we can look at the science, we can reference it to culture, we got all the kind of our peers and our mentors that are suggesting this is the way, and then we go ahead and try it, right? And how does it really feel for us? And this is kind of this idea where the intuitive eating comes into play. Again, intellectually, I could argue with you for hours of, you know, vegetarian and, you know, like you're saying, people like, if you eat too many carbs, it's going to kill you. You know, meat is undigestible. It's just going to putrefy in your gut. Well, once I actually like put that aside and actually just experience like eating meat again, I mean, it felt like it dissolved into my body. I felt like I had so much energy. I just couldn't deny it, right? It's like that's where the rubber hits the road, and that's really where we need to lead from and where we need to go is, you know, coming back to that intuition and going with following our gut, not nutrition trend, and having that personal experience as the foundation and the validator for sure. But one of the challenges is, you know, in terms of intuitive eating, let's say you just pull someone off the street and you say, you know what, I just want you to follow your gut. Just go with your instincts, eat whatever you want. Well, you know, potentially that's probably maybe what got us in trouble in the first place, right? The average person, like I was growing up as a kid, I mean, my favorite meal of the day was breakfast cereals, you know, like Fruit Loops, Lucky Charms. Like, I'd pour myself a bowl of that any time of day. So where we have to kind of come back to is natural, unprocessed, unadulterated foods. Because when something's, again, industrial food system, they've been designed and manufactured to kind of play and trick with our senses, right? Like high amounts of fat, high amounts of sugar is not natural, not found in nature, and our body's kind of hardwired and can be triggered that way to, you know, want to consume that. So we need to kind of come back to natural foods, reset our body, reset our senses, and lead with that. So fasting is a great technique to kind of recalibrate our body and our senses back to just natural flavors, right? Not artificial flavors, which are excitotoxins and stimulate the brain in kind of wrong and unnatural ways. Natural foods, using that as the base, that will, yeah, allow you to, again, follow your gut in more than nutrition trends. So.
Yeah, I think you're right about just experiencing how a food might make you feel the next day. You know, oh, I do want this pizza. I want this macaroni and cheese. Go ahead and eat it and then be aware of how it makes you feel the next day. I think that's very helpful.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And you know, big fan of the, although I wasn't always, I was definitely more that extreme person, but the 80-20, you know, that's where that idea of the flexitarian comes in. And, you know, 9 or 8, if we're going to use the 80-20, like 8 times out of 10, like I'm naturally just drawn to food that feels good, that I want to eat, that I do experience, that is like, yeah, this feels in the good in the body. And then there's those other times where, you know, it might just be an indulgence, or I might be out with the family and I'm with the in-laws and it's like, yeah, okay, this is just the food that's available. Oh, yeah. So you know what, I'm just going to go with it. And so that brings in another part of just not, you know, mindset, you know, not being so neurotic, right? Just like, because I think our state of mind, if I'm like eating that pizza or donut or whatever it is, going like, oh my gosh, it's going to kill me. This is terrible for me. you know, that's going to have a worse impact than, you know what, I do awesome, you know, most of the time, and I'm in the context of sharing food with the relatives, and someone's lovingly prepared this, and this is just all about fun. I'm just going to take that in. It's not my normal. You know, maybe I might have to take some enzymes afterwards or whatever. But you just go with it because that's the situation. So, you know, not being so neurotic and just being more, free. And I love how you said mindful as well. You know, if we can just really tune into food, and how it makes us feel and just be more grateful and more present with it.
Yeah, and yeah, you get home after going out with the in-laws and you mix up a nice bucket of psyllium husk and bentonite clay and you know
you know, and apple pectin,
get some
activated charcoal.
That's right, you know, and you'll, you know, and sleep it off. This kind of leads into a question that we had, which is a key to a healthy immune system, healthy mind, and healthy digestion is through the gut biome. I've heard you speak of that. And so I've always thought, or kind of recently had this idea that most important garden that we have, like the most important herb garden we have is our own gut biome. It's like our own, the most important, you know, garden that we should tend is the one in our tummies. You mentioned following your gut a lot. And so it seems like we need to get in touch with our gut. And also, if we're going to have proper intuition to know what to eat, well, we have to have a proper connection to our bodies. You know, and I think maybe that starts with our gut biome, like what's happening. happening there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I love that you brought that up. And that's part of it. Not only do we need to eat, you know, just natural foods, but like you say, have that balance in the gut and the microbiome. When I was going through nutrition school and I'd surrounded myself around other nutritionists, herbalists, that kind of thing, there was kind of the buzzword about candida. People learning about, you know, candida yeast and how that can often be at the source of a lot of cravings. Because of course, you know, we do have, there are good bacteria, there are bad bacteria, good yeast, bad yeast, etc. And this idea of the dysbiosis, or the imbalance of too many bad bacteria and bad yeast, like candida yeast, can cause an imbalance. And they can affect you, you know, psychologically. And then also we'll talk about too, like a depletion of good bacteria. We have all these different types of bacteria that live on, in, and around us. It's said that we are actually 10 times more bacteria than we are human cells. And which the biggest concentration is in our guts, but they literally cover every inch inside and out of us as well. And so we really are a community and a microbiome. And so we need a diversity, and it's been shown actually because of our kind of modern diet and lifestyle and environments that we're living in, that we're actually losing microbial diversity, and that, you know, previous generations and different cultures, especially if they're living a little bit closer to the land, more indigenously, that they have higher numbers and wider diversity of different strains of bacteria. It's curious you mentioned about, just thinking of another kind of note about the, you know, the potato diet, and who knows if they're using this for as reference, but I remember in, apparently there's a people in Peru, they live up in the highlands, and they eat, you know, their diet's almost exclusively like 90% potatoes, but yet they eat like 400 different varieties. They have all these different types. It's not like they're just eating russet Burbanks, you know, deep fried in canola every day, as their staple. And they're saying that one of the ways that helps them, like, you know, even able to do that is they have bacteria in their stomach. They're able to basically, you know, supplement the rest of what they need. These bacteria, you know, they are key for immune system, but they also manufacture, you know, vitamins like B vitamins. They produce neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. They're really key, involved in our digestion. And it's wonderful. I think this is kind of the new frontier of nutrition science. And I love, you know, the rabbit hole that we are going down with it. And one can keep going, and I definitely will. I love that aspect of nutrition and the nutrition science. But at the same time, it's super simple that, hey, we know this is good for us. We know that it's, again, good for digestion, good for the immune system, good for emotional and mental health. And we'll continue to discover more and more, I know, and I'm sure, because there's so much that we don't know about it. But on a simplistic level, even if we didn't have that knowledge, even if you don't want to go down that road, you know, eat fermented foods, right? It's just, you can still get there and get all the benefits just by following that path, regardless of where science is or isn't in terms of its understanding. So fermented foods, they do a couple of things. They help pre-digest the foods. We're talking about soy. We can even talk about wheat. I think one of the reasons why we have so many issues with wheat today is we're consuming it. A, there's the argument of probably potentially the hybridization into forms of, you know, too high gluten, the protein, et cetera, is different than what we've been able to digest in past. Potentially how we're growing it and things like glyphosates that we use in the kind of the growing and the harvesting of it. Desiccants, I heard, are sprayed on the fields to instantly dry it before harvest. Like, all that stuff has got to have an influence. But I think even still, primarily, it was usually always fermented, right? And these bacteria help us break down grains, nuts, seeds, even dairy, right? Like, you know, any of the dairy foods that we were consuming had natural bacteria and enzymes that would help break down things like the lactose. But if you just take straight milk, you know, fresh milk, pasteurize it, homogenize it, you don't have those living bacteria or those living enzymes to help you digest it. Now your body has to deal with it, and it can't.
When you say fermented, do you mean, or it had the enzymes in it, do you mean that it was like in the form of yogurt, or do you just mean that the raw dairy would have had natural
Yes, yeah. Okay. So the raw dairy, and a good example of that is, so any food, and this is me going back to my raw food days of, you know, why should we all eat raw food, is let's say an avocado contains a lot of fat. Well, within that kind of matrix of the avocado contains lipase enzymes, which is what helps break down fat. So if you don't have the enzyme in the food, then your body has to produce it. You know, it's okay, it can. And in the case of raw milk, it's got, you know, enzymes contained within it, but also these bacteria. So raw milk, you know, what happens if you just leave raw milk out on the counter? Just, you know, warm weather, doesn't matter. You don't refrigerate it. Just sit raw milk out on the counter. It naturally sours. The bacteria that are in there are like, they just begin to culture it. And in a way, it almost actually protects that milk. It just sours the milk. Whereas if you take pasteurized milk, take it out of the fridge, leave it on the counter, what happens? You know, it putrefies. It goes off to the point where, you know, I remember a friend of mine in elementary school, his mother had spilt milk in the car in the fall. Didn't quite clean it up as the winter set in, couldn't really clean it in her car. Like, no one wanted to do field trips with her because her car stunk. It was nasty. You didn't want to go in there. Right? So it putrefies because other, you know, again, not all bacteria are good. There are bad bacteria that we need to, you know, be mindful of, not consume, stay away from, etc. But that's a very small majority. However, in the case of this milk, you know, without those natural good probiotics, same with our body, you know, that's part of the reason why we need so many good probiotics to help us, you know, defend against the bad. Remove that from the milk, it's more susceptible to putrefaction versus just naturally souring and curdling. So when you take dairy, a lot of people have allergies or sensitivities. Some don't even know it, but most do. You know, drinking a glass of milk, it's like, they get the mucus, they get congestion, maybe get other symptoms because they're not able to digest it. However, take that same glass of milk, turn it into yogurt, turn it into cheese, turn it into kefir, you know, then it becomes a lot more digestible and utilizable by the body. Same with wheat, you know, sourdough breaks it down. That gluten's no longer a problem for a lot of people when it's in a fermented form.
And that's the only way we ate it back in the day, because I do look at, like, with the idea of ancestral nutrition, I look at my grandparents and my great-grandparents, etc., and I know, you know, for a fact, knowing a bit of the family history, that they ate a crap ton of wheat, you know, but yet they were really healthy and lived to be, you know, quite old, but the only bread there was sourdough, and they, you know, it didn't come pre-sliced.
So. Right. There you go. And then there's that cultural reference, right?
Again. Yeah. There's many superfoods you feel passionate about, and two in particular are mushrooms such as chaga and reishi, and the ever-popular chocolate. Can you educate the audience on the numerous health benefits of these superfoods?
All right. Yeah, for sure. So medicinal mushrooms, this is something I love introducing people to, and we'll definitely get to chocolate as well, because that's another favorite for many reasons. So you've been talking about ancestral nutrition, and this is an idea that I definitely share with Daniel. I love what he's taught me about it. I've kind of put my own, you know, spin on it, what I call the natural food guide, or you could call it the ancestral food guide. And this is the idea of the four food groups, not the one that you were taught in school, that's kind of passed around in North America, but this idea of, you know, I think there is a natural diet for humans, and if you look at it almost as kingdoms of life, you know, again, I used to be a really hardcore vegetarian, or I was like, nope, it's plants all the way. And what I've really come to learn and accept is humans are omnivores, and we've lived all around the world in different situations and circumstances, and we eat everything. You know, I mean, that's omni, that's what it means. We eat everything, and we have lived and thrived, again, all the way from potato diets of people in Peru to, you know, primarily meat-based diets in a lot of northern cultures, in particular the Inuit, who still even did have a diversity of plants, but the majority of their nutrition and their calories definitely came from animals. So we've done it all, we've eaten it all. However, I think unanimously there are four things in every culture's diet, and, you know, Daniel's kind of extrapolated that out to, you know, the kingdoms of life, and you know, right now, technically, there are six if you break it down to the latest of research. But generically, we can put it into the four kingdoms or four food groups I call, which are plants, animals, bacteria, and fungi. And again, plants, animals, we can talk lots about that, but it's that information, it's already out there. What's often new to people is this idea of bacteria and fungi being, you know, necessary, vital food groups. We touched a little bit upon bacteria, and that would be our fermented foods. So they give us the benefit of, like we mentioned, pre-digesting our food, making it more utilizable, more absorbable, but then also the benefit of those living bacteria and how they become part of our ecosystem, our microbiome, in increasing our digestion, our immunity, and then having that mental and emotional, you know, balance and just optimal functioning. So that's bacteria. The other group would be fungi. And the fungi kingdom is large, and it's largely unexplored, untapped. But again, more and more, we're beginning to learn about it, and it's a fascinating frontier. Within the fungi kingdom, we have all the way from our single-celled yeasts, things like Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which are the yeast responsible for leavening our bread and fermenting our beer, all the way to, you know, our button mushrooms, right? Like the ones you can get at the store, your white buttons, your portobellos, those gilled mushrooms. And then you also have what are called the medicinal mushrooms. So kind of the fermenting ones, the culinary ones, and the medicinal ones. And most of us just kind of recognize white buttons, and we either like them or we don't. But there's so much beyond that, and not only for food, but also for medicine. And it was Otzi the Iceman is the kind of oldest, most intact human specimen that we have. He was found, you know, literally like flash frozen in the ground, unearthed, and he still had all his possessions on him, and he was actually carrying him on him among, you know, the very, very few things that he had, two different species of mushrooms that he was using partly as medicine, as well as they had some other functions as well. So we know humans have used mushrooms as a source of medicine for long time, for millennia, and we continue to use them today. Like penicillin is a medicine, and again, one type, one form of fungi, and this idea of medicinal mushrooms is kind of catching wind, becoming trendy. And this is the idea of things like reishi mushroom or chaga mushroom, shiitake, maitake. And, you know, if we look at the food scope, kind of an acronym, the lens, science is definitely checking up on, you know, okay, what are the compounds in these things? You know, being anti-cancer, antifungal, helping lower cholesterol, like the list goes on and on about all their benefits and their effects on the body and the compounds that they contain. Culturally, you know, like in Chinese herbal medicine, for instance, reishi or ling qi has been revered for centuries as kind of like a panacea almost in terms of being good for so many different maladies or ailments. And it's said that that's, you know, one of the most revered and studied and well-used herbs in the world is reishi mushroom. And that's certainly one of my favorites. And it's described as what we call a tonic, and it's a herb that you can take every day that helps, you know, build the immune system. In fact, actually, it's what they call dual directional as well. So let's say you have an overactive immune system in one person and an underactive immune system in another, they can both take reishi, because in the one, it'll help raise it up, and in the other, it'll help lower it down. So it has a certain intelligence and a diversity of properties and chemicals in it that it can work for both people. It's not just one directional. It's not all about, you know, just lowering insulin, for instance. It has that ability to do both, and they call that dual directional. And that's what puts it in this idea of a tonic or a superior herb or an adaptogen. These are some names that you might have heard of. Different than in the Chinese system that has thousands of herbs. And if you want to be a Chinese doctor, I mean, you go to school and you learn all the different herbs and their combinations and this and that. But really, when it comes down to it, they're superior, they're tonic herbs. There's, you know, about 100. that really have these exceptional abilities. And this has been discovered over, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of use. And there's just a few that have risen to the top. And reishi mushroom is definitely one of those. So lots of great cultural references to their uses and their benefits. Chaga is one that grows in a lot of the northern hemisphere, particularly on birch trees. So you've got references to, you know, Russian and Eastern European cultures using it for everything that's good for. And science is saying it's one of the highest antioxidant sources, for instance. So yeah, there's a little bit about mushrooms, and it's a great thing to introduce people that they can just kind of add in. I mean, I've had a number of mothers come to the store and start adding in, like, say, a mushroom blend for themselves, their kids, and, you know, they're getting sick less often in that case. So
what's some of your favorite ways of, or what would you say are the most effective and or easy ways to incorporate medicinal mushrooms into a diet?
Yeah, totally. So many different ways. You know, there are some mushrooms that are both culinary and medicinal. So in the case of shiitake or maitake, they're really choice, wonderful, delicious, edible mushrooms that have these great medicinal properties. So those, you know, throw them into stir fries, into soups, that kind of thing. A lot of the other mushrooms, like these polypores, they're called, you can't actually eat as a food, so you're making a tea, or you can buy it in a form where somebody's already done like an extract, either through alcohol or hot water, and it's in a powder or in a liquid form, and you can take it that way. And in the powder, I love to throw it into smoothies or chocolate, which we're going to talk about. So many, many different ways to get it in there.
In the raw chocolate that's setting up in the fridge, you'll often find medicinal mushrooms here too in the form of powder. So yeah, on to chocolate.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, again, chocolate, what an amazing food. I mean, we all know, whether we know from science and studies, but which is kind of revealing, you know, what is the mystery? What is it about chocolate we all love? But we all do love it and experience its wonders and its properties. And yeah, it's just one of those magical foods that I really enjoy and, you know, grew up eating, loving, devouring. And as I got deep into the world of food and nutrition, I was doing everything from scratch, right? It was because this idea of whole foods, I wanted to make sure I got as close to the source as possible. I wanted to kind of limit what I went in there, how it was being made, preservatives, et cetera, et cetera. But yet chocolate had totally, you know, evaded me. I was still eating candy bars and white sugar because I love chocolate. I just didn't know there was any other alternative. I hadn't made that connection to the source of chocolate. They say there's kids in, you know, inner city New York that don't know where apples come from. I mean, I hope it's not that bad. I hope we have enough of a connection to our food system that, you know, apples don't just come from grocery stores. They actually come from trees. But, you know, if you talk to me, like, you know, 10, 15 years ago, like deep in my, like, you know, whole food journey, I hadn't even, you know, I was trying to do everything from scratch, but I hadn't yet questioned chocolate. It was just kind of one of those, you know, closet addictions that I, you know, was secretly would stash candy bars and eat them. And it wasn't until later that I got introduced to the whole food of chocolate, which is the source, which is the cacao bean, which, you know, all science does keeps coming out with all the benefits of, you know, what's in chocolate, what makes it so good. And the question is, you know, is that in the cacao bean or is it in the Hershey's bar? Well, obviously, like, this, it comes from the source. It's all contained within the cacao bean. So then my goal was, okay, how can I still have and enjoy chocolate in the form that I know, like bars and sauce and fudge and this and that, but it be as close to the bean and get as much of those good benefits as possible and without all the kind of the negatives and the detriments, be it the white sugar, be it the milk powder, you know, those types of things. So I got into making my own chocolate, and that is just such a revelation and something I've turned a lot of people onto, is being your own chocolate maker. It's one of the funnest, most enjoyable and delicious things that, A, you get to make, and most people have never had fresh chocolate. Like, it's just like anything other fresh, right? It's like there's a difference between, you know, bread that's 2 hours old and bread that's 2 weeks old. And chocolate, most of what we find on the shelves is probably made 6 months or a year ago and has been through all kinds of processing and this and that. So when you actually taste and you experience fresh chocolate, I mean, that is a revelation in itself. Then when you make it yourself, you get to choose what type of sweetener you put in. I could suddenly now finally say, I don't eat white sugar because, you know, chocolate was kind of the final frontier where, you know, I was just like, well, I either eat white sugar or I don't have chocolate. And I'm not always about to give it up at that time. So I can make chocolate with my choice now. I can put in honey. I can put in maple syrup. I can put in, you know, whatever I want that will suit me and my body and my needs. And anyone can do that too. Then the third most exciting thing is you can use it. It is what I like to call the Trojan horse of good nutrition, because no matter what you put inside, it'll get past anyone's pearly gates. So not only have you made, you know, this amazing, wonderful, delicious chocolate that you could feed to your family that does not want to touch your green smoothie or eat your mushrooms, you know, you could say, well, how about you try some of my chocolate? And they will happily accept that wonderful, delicious looking chocolate bar. And then later on, you can tell them, well, I put in spirulina and I put in reishi mushroom and I put in this, I put in that. And it becomes this wonderful delivery system for these types of herbs. And in fact, that's, again, how it was culturally traditionally used, especially in Mesoamerica, you know, the Aztecs and the Mayans that we know had a deep connection and a love for chocolate would consume it most often as a beverage. You know, the technology of turning it into bars and such hadn't been discovered or developed by them. So, you know, they were drinking it as a beverage, but it was most often always mixed with, you know, things like cayenne or allspice or, you know, different flowers, mushrooms even. And it was always this kind of potent, like herbal, medicinal, nutritious brew. So we can do that too. And you can see that, obviously. That's what happens even with our chocolate bars that we can buy. There's this idea of the craft chocolate maker, which I love, that's exploding right now. Similar to craft beer, where you walk into your liquor store and it's like, oh my gosh, wow, look at all these different varieties. There's kelp stouts and spruce beers and this and that. Like, the world of chocolate is again moving away from this mass scale industrialization of, you know, big corporations like Hershey's and Cadbury, where it's, you know, chocolate has become a commodity. And in that sense, the quality has gone so down because of the scale's gone so up. There's this kind of reversal from Wall Street to Main Street, and it's coming back on that small local scale. The chocolate's being grown more consciously, heirloom varieties, the flavor is there, and the artisans that are working with it, making it, are paying more attention to that and to the quality. And then we're getting more creative and more fun with the flavors and how we're using chocolate. And that's the whole point of doing it at home as well. So that's what gets me excited about chocolate.
I don't think there's a better way to stick it to the man than with raw chocolate, just to be honest with you.
For sure, right?
Yeah.
Hershey's tastes like poison after you've had raw chocolate. It really does. It tastes bitter.
Yeah. Well, and that's it. So, you know, that's a great point to kind of bring it all back, right? Is like experience. It's that personal experience. It's like, we don't even need to talk about like the industry and how bad, you know, Hershey's is and da, 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 da. It's like, here, try this. Now try that and let people experience. It's like even blindfold, like, oh, wow. Like the taste, the feeling, the sensations, like, you know, is all just so much there, so much more there, benefit everything without even saying a word. And then we just let all the rest of it go. It's like that can just all fall away.
Planning on franchising your...
I get that question all the time, actually, yeah. And have throughout the years. I get people visiting me from LA to Toronto to Vancouver, all over, and they say, you know, man, this is where I live. I would love to see this. And my answer is no.
Oh. I like that.
Yeah, only because I don't think that's the point, right? Mm-hmm. I'm flattered. I think it's great that we've created something unique. But what I'd like to see is more unique things, mm-hmm. you know? And again, it's this movement away from Wall Street to Main Street. And so maybe what I might do and what's more aligned in my path is helping other people that might have the idea, their inspiration, mm-hmm. time, the energy that we create, something like that. But they can do it in their own expression versus, you know, here's the cookie cutter model and you got to do it this way. I think we need more creativity and individuality and less franchises in our world for sure. you know, one thing is I'm definitely interested and love to do, and why I'm on this show, and I love the experience we're having here is you know, I can, through the power of the internet, share more of my journey and what I've come to know. And again, it's not the be all end all. I don't have the answers, but if it helps someone on their journey, again, in that kind of opinion, so they can help put all the pieces together, then that's great. And I'm happy to continue getting out there and doing that.
You can find out more about Malcolm's approach to health at his website, malcolmsaunders.com. There you'll find an array of topics such as intuitive eating, wild harvesting, and fermentation. The website of his health food store, The Light Cellar, contains a wealth of educational videos as well as information on his upcoming workshops. Find it at thelightcellar.ca. Follow Malcolm on Instagram at The Malcolmist. That's MALCHEMIST. Find all these links and more in show notes under this podcast at radiantcreators.com.